100 years ago this week, the United States entered World War I. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, we mark the 100th anniversary of America's Declaration of War. Thousands of visitors gathered at the National World War I Museum and Memorial in Kansas City for the National Centennial Commemoration, which featured music, cannon fire, dignitaries from around the world, and a dramatic narration of the events leading up to April 6, 1917. We've got highlights from that ceremony, plus an interview with University of Kansas history professor and military historian Jennifer Weber. We'll also tour some World War I sites right here on the KU campus. But first, the National Centennial Ceremony from the National World War I Museum in Kansas City. The day started with a flyover from the Patrouille de France, eight jets from the French Air Force trailing streams of red, white, and blue.
On these grounds, 96 years ago, the Allied commanders from the nations of France, Italy, Belgium, the United Kingdom, and the United States stood. Together with a crowd that filled the park, they came to dedicate this land as a place of remembrance, of solemn memory.
Dr. Matthew Naylor is the president and CEO of the National World War I Museum and Memorial.
They did so at the invitation of the people of Kansas City, who just 2 years before responded to the war's end by committing themselves to build a memorial to honor the war dead and as a tribute for peace. In just 10 days, in early 1919, 83,000 people in this community raised $2.5 million, almost $40 million in today's terms. On these grounds in 1926 stood President Calvin Coolidge to dedicate the memorial. With crowds filling this mall, he spoke of the memorial's purpose as having been built in memory of those who defended their homes and their freedoms, as not having been raised to commemorate war and victory, but rather the results of war and victory, which are embodied in peace and liberty. And so it is fitting that on behalf of the board, our staff and volunteers, and the donors who support this world-class museum and memorial, I welcome you to the place where, for the past 91 years, people from across the globe have come to learn and remember. 65 million people served in the war. Each year, more than 500,000 people remember them here. Above the great frieze of the north side of the memorial are carved by a veteran of World War I these words in stone that express well the yearnings of our forebears who dreamed of this place and who have stewarded it through the years. They echo truths to us today. These have dared bear torches of sacrifice and service. Their bodies return to dust, but their work liveth forevermore. Let us strive on to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace amongst ourselves and with all nations. Ladies and gentlemen, we are glad to welcome you here today to one of the world's great museums and memorials.
Dr. Matthew Naylor is the president and CEO of the National World War I Museum and Memorial. Commissioner Colonel Robert D'Alessandro is the chair of the U.S. World War I Centennial.
The United States entered the war on April 6, 1917. The decision was not an easy one. And as you'll see in this ceremony, America entered the war to bring liberty, democracy, and peace to the world after almost 3 years of unprecedented hardship, strife, and horror. During the war, America saw dramatic changes in technology, in medicine, in civil rights, in women's suffrage. Our soldiers began the war on horseback and ended their efforts employing armored vehicles and airplanes. The brave men and women who served in World War I would become the parents of the greatest generation that would lead the world to liberty and peace for over 30 years, and later would lead them to years more of peace. World War I marked the true beginning of the American century. Today, on April 6, 2017, 100 years hence, we assemble in the shadow of this great memorial to hear the voices and relive the human experience that more than any other in modern history fundamentally changed our nation, helped define our national culture, and established the world that we live in today. We still live in the long shadow of World War I in every aspect of our lives. Our audience here today is a cross-section of America. It includes serving military members and veterans of the military service, members of organizations and military units that can trace their origins back to World War I, veteran service organizations such as the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the American Legion, the Military Order of the World Wars, and thousands of our nation's citizens who have come to pay honor to their fellow citizens 100 years ago. I thank each of you for being here today. I also welcome and want to thank the international dignitaries of some 30 nations who join us here. To our audience gathered here today, and to all those watching us from afar, we thank you for taking this time to learn about and reflect on the history of World War I and the United States' involvement in that war, and to honor the sacrifice and service of those Americans who served. Thank you, and God bless the United States of America.
I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, we mark the 100th anniversary of America's entry into World War I. The National Centennial Commemoration at the World War I Museum and Memorial told the story of events leading up to April 6, 1917, a story that begins with the outbreak of war in Europe in 1914 and is at the heart of the 1916 American presidential election.
Wilson, running for a second term, built his candidacy around the idea that America ought to prepare for the possibility of war. Yet his campaign slogans, "He kept us out of war" and "America first," persuaded the American public that a vote for the Republican candidate, Charles Evans Hughes, would be a vote for war. While many embraced the slogans, others criticized them. Teddy Roosevelt:
"President Wilson's ignoble shirking of responsibility has been misclothed in the phrase of a coward. He kept us out of war. In actual reality, war has been creeping nearer, and we face it without policy, plan, purpose, or preparation."
In September 1916, Wilson accepted the Democratic nomination for president.
"We have been neutral, not only because it was the fixed and traditional policy of the United States to stand aloof from the politics of Europe, but also because it was manifestly our duty to prevent the indefinite extension of the fires of hate and desolation kindled by that terrible conflict, and to seek to serve mankind by reserving our strength and our resources for the difficult days of restoration and healing, when peace will have to build a house anew."
The debate reached every corner of American society. American Arthur Bullard, who had lived in wartime France and England, wrote in early 1917,
"Whatever the diplomats may like to call it, this is war, and we do not know how to fight. We have no American general who ever commanded an army corps. Not one of our naval officers ever fought against a dreadnought. None of our artillerymen ever fired a real shot in an enemy aircraft. We must learn. The war is upon us, and we must decide what we are going to do about it. We who love peace ought to keep out of war as long as possible, and when we are forced to go in hard."
The outcome of the 1916 election reflected divisions in the country. Winning by a slim electoral college margin, Wilson's second term would soon face a series of crises that would determine the fate of his neutral position in the war. While debate raged in America, the slaughter continued in Europe. Rapid advances in the technology of weapons of war led to vast devastation. For the first time in history, the battlefield saw the use of tanks, chemical weapons, machine guns, long-range artillery, and aircraft.
65 million men fought in the war from 40 countries.
21 million were wounded.
8 million died, roughly 3,000 every day.
6.5 million civilians were killed, including 2 million in Russia alone.
110,000 tons of poison gas was used, killing nearly 500,000 men.
In Europe alone, approximately 10 million people were displaced by the war, including 1.8 Armenians forcibly deported to the Syrian desert.
1.5 million Belgians were refugees from the Germans.
In the Battle of Somme, fought between July and November of 1916, 1.2 million men perished for a meager Allied gain of 7.8 miles of territory.
Not long after the election of 1916, events would unfold at a rapid pace until the United States reached a tipping point where isolationism could no longer be an option. January 19, 1917, Arthur Zimmermann, Foreign Secretary of the German Empire, sent a telegram to the German ambassador to Mexico proposing an alliance between Germany and Mexico in the event of U.S. entry into the war.
We intend to begin on the 1st of February unrestricted submarine warfare. We shall endeavor, in spite of this, to keep the United States of America neutral. In the event of this not succeeding, we make Mexico a proposal of alliance, make war together, make peace together, and an understanding that Mexico is to reconquer the lost territory in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. You will inform the President of the above as soon as the outbreak of war with the United States of America is certain.
The British Admiralty, which had cracked the German diplomatic cipher systems, decoded the message within hours. Seeking to influence the American government, the British provided the Americans a copy of the telegram. On the 28th of February, President Wilson released the telegram to the press. The appearance of the news nationwide on March 1st galvanized American support for entry into the war. January 31st, 1917, Robert Lansing, Secretary of State, received a note from the German ambassador to the United States.
A new situation has been created which forces Germany to new decisions. England is using her naval power for a criminal attempt to force Germany into submission by starvation. From February 1st, 1917, sea traffic will be stopped with every available weapon and without further notice.
This message from the German ambassador directly contravened the German guarantee to Wilson that ended unrestricted submarine warfare following the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915. Coupled with the Zimmermann telegram, Germany's renewed aggression decisively changed Americans' attitudes about the war. On February 3, 1917, the United States formally ended diplomatic relations with Imperial Germany. On February 25, 1917, the Cunard Line ship Laconia was struck by German torpedoes. Floyd Gibbons, an American correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, was on board and lived to describe the scene.
At 10:30 p.m., there was a muffled noise. Five sharp blasts. The signal to abandon. We looked down the slanting side of the ship and noticed her waterline was a number of feet above the waves. The lifeboats rested against the side of the ship. I could see that we were going to have difficulty in the descent to the water. "Lower away!" someone gave the order, and we started down toward the seemingly hungry swells. The stern of the boat was down, the bow up, leaving us at an angle of about 45 degrees. The tiers of lights dimmed slowly from white to yellow, then to red, and nothing was left but the murky morning of the night. The ship sank rapidly at the stern until at last its nose stood straight in the air. And then it slid silently down and out of sight.
March 20, Wilson confers with his cabinet. They unanimously vote for war. On the evening of April the 2nd, 1917, President Wilson addresses a joint session of Congress asking for a declaration of war.
While we do these momentous things, let us make clear to all the world what our motives are. Our object now as then is to vindicate the principles of peace and justice as against selfish and autocratic power. Neutrality is no longer feasible or desirable where the peace of the world is involved and the freedom of its principles. And the menace to that peace and freedom lies in the existence of autocratic governments. We have seen the last of neutrality. We are at the beginning of an age in which it will be insisted that the same standards of conduct and of responsibility for wrong done shall be observed among nations and their governments that are observed among the individual citizens of civilized states.
The Congress rose to its feet and applauded enthusiastically. Cheering crowds lined the streets as Wilson departed from the Capitol. As author Byron Farwell wrote,
"It was the greatest speech of Wilson's life. At about 10 o'clock, when the president had returned to the White House, he and his wife had dinner with friends, after which Wilson wandered into the empty cabinet room. His secretary, Joseph Tumulty, found him there. Think what they were applauding, he said to Tumulty. My message today was a message of death for our young men. How strange it seems to applaud that. He put his head down on the table in the cabinet room and sobbed.
Still, in the face of aggression, there were voices of opposition. Arkansas Senator George Norris.
Belligerency would benefit only the class of people who will be made prosperous should we become entangled in this present war, who have already made millions, and who will make hundreds of millions more if we get into the war. To whom does the war bring prosperity? Not to the soldier. Not to the broken-hearted widow, not to the mother who weeps at the death of her brave boy. I feel that we are about to put the dollar sign on the American flag."
The Senate passed the war resolution with only 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats opposed. The House voted 373 for, with 50 opposed. The approved declaration of war was sent to President Wilson on April 6, 1917. At 1 p.m. that day, he signed, "Approved, 6, April, 1917, Woodrow Wilson." I have a rendezvous with death at some disputed barricade. When spring comes back with rustling shade and apple blossoms fill the air, I have a rendezvous with death when spring brings back blue days and fair. It may be he shall take my hand and lead me into his dark land and close my eyes and quench my breath. It may be I shall pass him still. I have a rendezvous with death on some scarred slope of battered hill when spring comes round again this year and the first meadow flowers appear. God knows 'twere better to be deep pillowed in silk and scented down where love throbs out in blissful sleep, pulse nigh to pulse and breath to breath, where hushed awakenings are dear. But I've a rendezvous with death at midnight in some flaming town when spring trips north again this year, and I to my pledged word am true. I shall not fail that rendezvous.
Rouge Bouquet by Sergeant Joyce Kilmer. In a wood they call the Rouge Bouquet, there is a new-made grave today, built by never a spade nor pick, yet covered with earth 10 meters thick. There lie many fighting men, dead in their youthful prime, never to laugh nor love again, nor taste the summertime. For death came flying through the air and stopped his flight at the dugout stair and touched his prey and left them there, clay to clay. He hid their bodies stealthily in the soil of the land they fought to free and fled away. Now over the grave, abrupt and clear, 3 volleys ring, and perhaps their brave young spirits hear the bugle sing, "Go to sleep, go to sleep."
You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, we're marking the 100th anniversary of America's entry into World War I, with highlights from the National Centennial Commemoration at the World War I Museum and Memorial in Kansas City. And now, voices from abroad. Ambassadors from Australia, Austria, Belgium, France, and England react to America's declaration of war on April 6, 1917.
America is trembling on the verge of war. We are today so far from having won our way out of the maelstrom of war into the calm, smooth waters of peace, in the very vortex of its awful fury. The Sydney Morning Herald reported 6th of April, 1917, "There is nothing in the history of war more remarkable than the enthusiasm with which the American people have received the President's advice to declare themselves at war with Germany." An Australian at the front line, Private James Joseph Macon, wrote to his mother and father, "I suppose you are following all the latest operations with much interest, and you should be exceptionally glad America has come in at last."
From a diplomatic message sent by Count Ottokar Czernin, Foreign Minister of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in reaction to the US declaration of war to Germany. "Since the United States of America has declared that a state of war exists between it and the Imperial German government, Austria-Hungary, as an ally of the German Empire, has decided to break off diplomatic relations with the United States, and the Imperial and Royal Embassy at Washington has been instructed to inform the Department of State to that effect. On December 7, 1917, the U.S. declared war on Austria-Hungary, and although there had hardly been any actual hostilities between the two countries, America's entry into the war and its subsequent diplomacy contributed greatly to Austria-Hungary's demise."
The Belgian Prime Minister and Minister of War, Charles de Broglie, sent the following message by cable to President Wilson. "The Belgian government decided in August 1914 to make an unprecedented application to Your Excellency. Our people, small in number, but strong in indomitable purpose, had foreseen that in the American people and in you, it would find support for its honor and an avenging arm for its martyrdom. The Belgian government salutes with joy, emotion, and respectful admiration the decisive act that, through the intermediary of Your Excellency, honors the man, the nation, and humanity."
Prime Minister David Lloyd George to the American people, 6th of April, 1917. America has at one bound become a world power in a sense she never was before. She waited until she found a cause worthy of her traditions. The American people held back until they were fully convinced that the fight was not a sordid scrimmage for power and possessions, but an unselfish struggle to overthrow a sinister conspiracy against human liberty and human rights. Once that conviction was reached, the great Republic of the West has leaped into the arena, and she stands new, side by side with the European democracies who, bruised and bleeding after 3 years of grim conflict, are still fighting the most savage foe that ever menaced the freedom of the world. The Imperial War Cabinet, representative of all the peoples of the British Empire, wish me on their behalf to recognize the chivalry and courage which call the people of the United States to dedicate the whole of their resources to the greatest cause that ever engaged human endeavor.
On April 5th, 1917, the French president of the Council of Ministers is addressing the French Senate. What particularly touches us is that the U.S. has always kept alive that friendship towards us, which was sealed with our blood. We recognize with joy that the U.S. flag is going to float beside ours. Our hands shall join, and our hearts shall beat in unison. The powerful and decisive assistance which the U.S. brings us will be not material aid alone. It will be moral aid above all, a veritable consolation. As we see the conscience of the whole world stirred in mighty protest against the atrocities of which we are victims, we feel that we are fighting not alone for ourselves and our allies, but for something immortal, that we are striving to establish a new order. And so, our sacrifices have not been in vain. The blood poured out so generously by the sons of France have been shed in order to spread liberty and justice, which are necessary for the establishment of concord among nations. In the name of France, in the name of the government of the French Republic, we address to the government and the people of the United States an expression of our gratitudes and our most ardent greetings.
Cannon fire from the National World War I Centennial, held April 6, 2017 at the National World War I Museum and Memorial in Kansas City. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. The United States entered the war on April 6, 1917, and its effects would be felt in almost every American institution, including the University of Kansas. Mike Reed is the former director of public affairs at KU.
The first thing I always think about when I think of World War I at KU is Dr. Fitzsimons, who was the first casualty of the war from the United States. And he was a KU grad, went through KU Med and got his degree. And the story about him was kind of sad. He actually did not have a shift the night that he was killed. He traded with somebody else. And so he was working while the other one was having fun that night. And so the guy that he traded with, he kind of went through some guilt about it later, is from what I read. But it just happenstance that he happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was at a medical facility, and it was bombed. And that's how he died.
What are some of the other KU connections?
Actually, there's a lot of connections, and more than I ever knew before I started looking into it more. And of course, I work here at the KU Memorial Unions, and we are a memorial to all the students and alumni that died during the war. There's about 130 people that did die from KU. And not only is the Union a memorial, but Memorial Stadium is a memorial to all the soldiers that died during World War One. And there was a big million-dollar drive, they called it, back in 1919. That's when it began, to build three different memorials on campus, two to World War One, and another to the first dean of law, Jimmy Green. That's the statue up by Lippincott Hall.
What about the Campanile?
Campanile is a World War II memorial. The stadium and the university learned from the stadium and the Union that maybe buildings aren't the best way to have a memorial because people don't remember that's what they are. I mean, we still have it in our names, the KU Memorial Union, and we still call it Memorial Stadium, but people forget what it really is a memorial to. So the Campanile was the first one that was built only to be a memorial and not have any building purpose or any other purpose on campus. But the more I've looked into it, there's a lot more sites and so many sites that we could pick. People walk over these areas every day and don't realize all the other things that went on, including Strong Hall. Frank Strong, who was a chancellor at the time, he was a pacifist and really did not want to get into the war. He felt bad, of course, that Europe was undergoing all the fighting, but he spoke out against the U.S. entering the war. But the day that we declared war, he turned 180 and threw the whole resources of the campus into the war effort.
Well, and to be fair, a lot of Americans didn't want to get involved in World War One.
That's true. I mean, he wasn't the only one. But he was really vocal about it. He talked to people in Washington, you know, talked against the war and would write other things, would go out speaking against entering the war. But to his credit, when we did get involved, he really got behind it. And it really was to the detriment to the university to do so. But they sacrificed, just like a lot of people did, because of the war effort.
Let's go out and take a look at some of the spots on campus.
Okay. We're on the top floor of the Kansas Union on Jayhawk Boulevard. And this is right adjacent to our stair tower, which we call the Traditions Tower. And right outside, we have two different history panels that describe KU's participation in both World War One and World War II. There were a lot of different ways that people did participate. Their students would do drills on their own or under the guidance of faculty. They were required to do so, both calisthenics and some of the firearms training, although it was fake guns. And then we also had a bunch of military men come up, and they started having classes just for them to learn. So they took over the campus, really. Then down in the tower itself, we have all the pictures of all the casualties from KU that were in World War One. There's 129 on this board, I believe. I think now they know there's 130, so we might have to still find one more picture.
So what can you tell me about that drive to raise money for these two facilities?
Well, it was a big effort, and everybody got involved, students, faculty, staff. Unfortunately, most of it raised the first few weeks of the drive, and they didn't get all the pledges in, which KPR is probably familiar with that.
The perils of fundraising.
But they did get $684,000, and the bad part about it from the union's point of view, Fogg Allen was one of the committee members, the memorial committee, and they built the stadium first, and they didn't have enough money to build the union after they did that. So they had to wait a few years, and so they started construction on the Union with laying the cornerstone in 1925, but the building wasn't complete until 1938.
So like many times in universities' histories, you could make the argument that athletics maybe took precedence over...
You said that, I didn't. Okay.
Is there anything special we should know about Memorial Stadium?
Yeah.
Other than the fact that
there's one other thing I wanted to point out. The space to the east of the stadium, as you see it right now, most that whole space and space on the practice fields down there were all taken up during the war with wood barracks for soldiers and for the Army Student Training Corps. This whole space almost, there must have been 10 different barracks built all the way down to 11th Street up this way. And most people don't realize that, that served another purpose. And even a Memorial Stadium during World War II, we ran out of housing as soon as the war was over, and a lot of students lived in Memorial Stadium underneath the bleachers.
There's a place to live
there in? There used to be apartments that were built into the basement, showers, restrooms, everything was in there. I know the bookstore here used to use those for storage over the years, but I think they've taken them out now. Warren Corman, one of the famous architects of campus, was one of the students that lived down there.
The area that you said was taken up with barracks is now the practice field.
Yeah, the east side of the practice field, that parking lot down there, all the way down to the street. At the time, Memorial Stadium, of course, wasn't there. McCook Field is what they called the area then, and the football field ran the opposite direction than the stadium does now. As soon as the war was over, within months, they had them all gone. In December of 1918, they took them down.
So what a fitting tribute that Memorial Stadium should stand
right there in
approximately
the same,
same place.
Yeah.
At this point, we're down on the fourth floor, the main lobby.
Main lobby area, yes.
There's a plaque here. Could you read it for me, Mike, and tell me the story about this?
It says, Kansas Memorial Union Building, elected in memory of the 129 students and alumni of the University of Kansas who gave their lives in service in the World War. And it was presented by the class in 1924. It's a large bronze tablet, probably weighs about 50 pounds or so.
And it's right, just to get our bearings, it's right at the top of the staircase, what you call the...
Yeah, the Traditions Tower, we call it.
There's a story behind this plaque.
Yeah, originally the plaque was on the outside of the Union at the main entrance. And we did a renovation back in the early 90s of the building. And so they had to take the plaque down so they could build the column up bigger. Well, they took it down, and then they built the column up bigger, and everybody forgot that they had taken that plaque down. Nobody realized it was missing, but it did get stolen from the site. And about 4 years ago, I received a phone call from somebody in Illinois saying they had discovered this plaque in a fraternity house at the University of Illinois and wondered if I wanted the plaque back. And we were all kind of surprised because nobody remembered the plaque at all. I immediately went to J. Ecker Yearbook to start looking for pictures, and I did find a plaque on the front of the building, and luckily the woman offered to have her brother bring the plaque back home to KU, and now we're leaving it indoors where we can see it all the time and know that it's still here.
Those crazy frat boys. Did you ever hear the story of who exactly took it and how it ended up
no.
in Illinois?
No, I never have figured out why or when, or when I looked at football schedules trying to see, well, did we play University of Illinois during that time frame, and some of those guys were here on campus. I couldn't find any connection of University of Illinois in here, so I have no idea how it got out there.
There must be a great story.
Yeah, it'll probably be a mystery forever. Yeah.
All right, so show me something else.
Well,
do we need to venture outside?
Yeah, let's go walking down the road.
Okay.
We're walking up towards the Natural History Museum, and we'll go past the Lippincott Hall. That Lippincott Hall is used to be Green Hall, the law school, and that's where they had the sign up, the enrollment for the Army's student training corps. When they had that, at 6:30 in the morning, the line formed for 8 o'clock, and the line went all the way from Lippincott Hall down here to the 13th Street area. That's how many students were interested in signing up.
People waiting to enlist.
Yes. It's kind of hard to believe that they were that eager, but as soon as we entered the war, they got behind it real fast. And actually this area here, the same place where we're walking, they did a lot of their drills. They'd march up and down this area.
So we're in front of Dyke Hall right now.
Right.
And they would do their exercises right here.
Right. And you have to remember, things looked a little different back in those days. I don't think we had any paved roads through here. There's a lot more grass in this area. But this is where they did a lot of their drills. They would drill down by Potter Lake, use the hills on that, you know, do drills and around the lake. They had all these courses they added to campus just for military training.
What type of
bridge
courses?
Building, telephony, a lot of engineering courses that were geared only to the war effort. There was at least 60 they added in the first year just for that purpose. And we had at least 45 faculty members left the campus to join the war for different parts. Of course, my favorite, James Naismith, he was one of them. He went to serve in France. There were 500 and some students that first semester that left here. It was in April they declared war, and before commencement, 500 already left, either to join up or to go back home and work on the farm. So right away, we were decimated by that.
We're standing in front of the old Green Hall, now Lippincott Hall. How did this figure into World War I? Well,
this is one of the main places they used for headquarters, but almost every building had some military headquarters within them. I did mention that $1 million drive and Jimmy Green statue is right here that earlier. So it wasn't a World War I memorial, but a lot of people do say the student is supposed to represent the first student from KU to die in any war, Alfred C. Alfred. And that statue was done by Daniel Chester French, who did the sitting Lincoln and Lincoln Memorial. So pretty famous artist. Let's go down here by Bailey Hall. Here's one of the things I wanted to point out. It was 1905 when helium was discovered here in this building in natural gas. McFarland, the two scientists that discovered helium. Now, all it did was sit in this building for many years in a little tube. And Katie would do more work on it. But when World War I came around, the government got involved. And they hired Katie to do more testing with helium because they knew that it could be something to replace hydrogen, which was too flammable for use in hot air or balloons. And the Germans were really using a lot of air balloons for spying and checking out fields and things like that. So they were kind of hesitant, I think, of making it too public that they were working on that here, because they didn't want the Germans to catch on to the idea of extracting helium. They wanted their balloons to be able to blow up. But so it really started the process, but the government really didn't start using it a lot until World War II, but this is where it started right here during World War I. So where we have Wesco Hall and Hoke Auditorium, the space between Marvin Hall and then up here in front of Strong Hall, there are barracks built there too. And not only did student Army Corps people live in these barracks, across the street where Strong Hall is, that part on the west of that was all the National Guard, the Kansas National Guard, Company M. They pitched tents out there, and they had a whole, their whole battalion, I guess is what you call them, out staying on campus in that area. So there were a lot of courses that were just made actually for their training too. That they had just got out of another war. They were all down on the Mexican border fighting Pancho Villa. So they really hadn't been home that long until they got called into service again, and they got back up to full strength, but they all came up here and lived on campus.
So World War I also affected the university in terms of how many students were here?
I think the number was over 3,000, and there was over 1,000 some students that were directly involved. Every student in some way was involved in the war effort. All of them had to go through training, drills, and calisthenics, male, female, both did. There were some that got to get out of some of those drills, but then they participated by making bandages and things like that over in Old Fraser Hall. Under the Red Cross, they'd be sitting down there making bandages during the day. Some were knitting things like socks and things like that to go overseas. So there was always something for everybody to do on campus. But to tell you the truth, it wore the students down and wore the faculty down. School spirit was at its lowest ebb at the time. People seemed like they quit caring about their normal activities. In fact, a lot of activities by order of the university were canceled. They weren't allowing a lot of dances like they used to, which they at one time they were having every night of the week. Those were canceled. Special banquets and stuff, they canceled those. So students also found that it was hard to live because they had to participate in a lot of these war efforts and could not keep their normal part-time jobs because they were required at a certain time to always go through the drills. So both faculty and the students really got worried just after the first year that it was not the campus life that you normally think of. Everybody's mind was on the war.
Mike Reed is the former director of public affairs for KU's Memorial Union. You can find out more about KU and World War I at www.kuhistory.com or on Facebook under KU History. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. For the rest of this hour, a conversation with Dr. Jennifer Weber. She's a military historian and professor of history at KU. I've stopped by her office earlier this week to talk about the events leading up to America's decision to join in World War I 100 years ago.
The year before, in March of 1916, the United States had come to an agreement with the Germans that Germans would not torpedo shipping that belonged to neutral countries. So in this case, specifically the United States. If they were going to sink a ship, they had to determine whether there were weapons on board beforehand, and they had to give the people on board time to get off the ship. Then they could sink the ship. This held for 11 months. And in February of 1917, the Germans just decided that they could not continue to ignore neutral shipping and then started torpedoing neutral ships once again, the merchant ships. And that led to a lot of deaths of people who were not active participants in the war. They were civilians. That was one problem. The bigger problem, though, was something called the Zimmermann Telegram. This was something that the British had intercepted and decoded in January of 1917, but did not give to the Americans until the end of February. And what it was a telegram going from the Germans to the Mexicans, suggesting that they join forces, that the Mexicans join forces with the Germans, and promising that if/when Germany won the war, as a reward to its Mexican allies, it would give them the states of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. And together, that composed about half the amount of land that the United States had won from Mexico in the Mexican War in the 1840s. That the United States considered an act of war. And that is what drove Congress to meet in April of 1917 and to declare war on the Germans.
Professor Weber, I've heard you say that World War I was really a pivotal point in terms of modern history. Explain that to me.
It is difficult to imagine what the 20th century would have looked like without World War I, because without World War I, you don't get World War II. Without World War I, you don't have the collapse of every empire south of the Baltic and east of the Rhine. Those all go away. Think about the consequences for the United States if there had been no Soviet Union. No Soviet Union, no Cold War. What would that have looked like? I don't know. But it is so huge and so important. It sets off the independence movements in so many colonies of France and England and the Dutch. I believe it is the linchpin event of the 20th century, and I think it may be one of the most important events in human history.
You touched on something just there, that this really meant the end of imperial Europe, that we went into World War I with the British monarchy, which still exists, of course, the Russian monarchy, the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, and all of those would essentially collapse, with the exception of Great Britain, all of those would collapse by the end of World War I. Did anyone see that coming?
No. And the German monarchy also collapsed. No, nobody saw that coming. And this is the thing about war, generally. Wars are easy to get into and very, very hard to get out of. And they always have unintended consequences. No sane person would go into a war like World War I expecting to lose and expecting their loss to be so profound that their entire system of government that they had for, in some cases, hundreds of years, would just end, just collapse under its own weight. Nobody expected that at the outset. People thought this was going to be a short war.
Home by Christmas.
Yep. And wars rarely turn out that way.
One of the unintended consequences of World War I had to do not at all with the war, but with the spread of disease. Talk to me about the influenza epidemic of 1917.
Well, this actually begins, as far as we can tell, at Fort Riley.
Fort Riley here in Kansas.
Absolutely. What happens is somebody brings it in, probably from some farm. It makes its way around Fort Riley, and Fort Riley was one of the main training grounds for the American Army. So you get these doughboys coming down with the flu, and they're shipped out anyway, and they take the germs with them.
They're shipped out sick.
They're shipped out sick, and they take their germs with them. Now, they get to Europe. They're in contact with civilians. They're in contact with these armies. And think about this, that by the time the Americans have arrived, the Europeans have been, you know, throwing everything they have at each other for 3 years. There are significant hunger problems in large parts of Europe. You have a very vulnerable population, and here comes a very virulent disease. And this becomes a global epidemic that lasts well into 1919 and actually comes back to the United States via the returning soldiers. So the soldiers carry it twice over. But it is a horrible disease, and I'd have to check on this, but I think more, at least as many people die of Spanish influenza as died in the war.
Dr. Weber, you co-teach a class on World War I here at the University of Kansas. What is it that you hope that students learn from that class?
The main things I want them to take away are the ideas that war is easy to get into and very hard to get out of, and that war has unanticipated consequences. I think for some of these students, they may go on to become politicians and office holders, and they may one day be presented with having to make decisions of that kind, and I really want them to think hard, really hard, about whether this is a war worth fighting and whether they are open to the unanticipated consequences. I think some wars are worth fighting. I think a lot of wars are not. And at the top of that list of wars that were not worth fighting is World War I. It began over the assassination of not major figure, shall we say, in Europe, and because of the treaty system that the European powers had erected in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It just brought them all into something that turned out to be horribly violent, horribly costly in terms of both the financial aspect and in human blood. That should never have happened. It really should not. World War One is an absolute tragedy. It is a tragedy. And I would hope that thinking about the events of World War One would make us a little wiser and compel us to pause a bit before we decide to go into war.
Dr. Jennifer Weber is a military historian. She's a professor of history at the University of Kansas. We close today's KPR Presents with a duet from the National World War I Centennial Commemoration held April 6, 2017 in Kansas City. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.
America, I raised a boy for you. America, you'll find him staunch and true. Place a gun upon his shoulder. He is ready to die or do. America, he is my only one, my hope, my pride.
It's time to